I hope you had a good time last night. I did. So this, I guess this session is about the hardest of the hard. Obviously, every environmental story is a relatively hard sell these days. And but I, having covered this stuff for a while, it's clear to me that we're in a transition from an era. We've kind of done the easy stories, which were the stuff pouring into the Hudson River, like we worked on for a while, and unfiltered stuff pouring out of smokestacks into the air. All the Clean Air Acts and have been passed, except overseas, where there's still huge amounts of basic, good old-fashioned pollution stories. But the problem is, of course, they're way, way, way away from where you are, for the most part. And now we're into this realm that I've been talking about lately of the slow drip. Essentially, every story that's of consequence in this century on the environmental front, to me, is of the slow drip variety. So not only do you have the normal newsroom hurdles of trying to get interest in, from your editors in an environmental story, but you have the hurdle of uncertainty. These are things that don't happen, and of sort of invisibility. They're stealth. This is non-point source pollution, which is such a wonderful term. Can someone please invent a better way? Anyone in the room have a vote for how to describe that stuff?
Runoff.
All right. But runoff has runoff sounds too clean and neat, or for some reason, it's just that sounds like rain. You know, rain. So there's non-point source pollution. There's population. You know, there was one little news peg that just came as the United States is, you know, hitting its 300 millionth. And every once in a while, the UN issues another number. I had to look up. I have a story running in the next few days on climate, and I needed to get up to date on global population. And I just was thinking, in my head, it's 6.3. And, of course, I looked it online in one of these live update sites, and it's 6.5 already. How did that happen? But they're all very incremental. Yeah, they're all very incremental and subtle. So what do you do if you're especially interested, if you're a regional reporter or a national reporter, or you know, basically landlocked, meaning you're in the United States for the most part, or in one city for the most part? How do you branch out? How do you push out to integrate and link your community and remind your community, especially in this century of the world being flat and all that stuff, that there's a world out there when we're all so right now, meaning we, the public, are so entrenched and really focused on the here and now. And by the way, climate change is the ultimate slow drip. It's a gas produced by every single goddamn thing we do. It's the bubbles in beer at the same time. There's an exciting way to get your editor's attention. You know, it's the stuff that's you exhale right now is causing catastrophic climate change. And of course, no aspersions on any editors in the room, but as we all know, editors really don't understand this story. Oh, someone, who's waving over there? Or was that unrelated? So, how do you do it? And it is doable. I've seen it done. I've actually largely failed, frankly. I've written a bunch about sustainability off and on, but even at the great and glorious New York Times, we have really big constraints on our travel budgets. My beat is the global environment, but I only rarely get to actually experience the global environment. I did go to the Arctic 3 times, but that was it. And then the stock price got cut in half. And now, have you seen any exotic bylines from me lately? No. Burlington. And I'm staying in a $59 hotel down the street. It's not easy for me. So what I did was I went back online, and I know many of you are familiar with some of these stories. And then I'm going to move it to the panel here. There are ways to kind of get from here to there and to build out from the local to the global and to do it sometimes perhaps even not breaking the bank, sometimes probably, breaking the bank, but with good results. One thing that came to me, just I guess a really important notion here is just be thinking global once a day or once a week in your gig, whatever you're covering. Every community has a university within a few miles. Every newspaper office or TV station, somewhere around you there's a university, and somewhere in that university there's somebody who's got a grant to do something in someplace unusual. That's one thing. I've seen the Michigan papers have done a lot of really good reporting on Michigan State University's programs on things ranging from panda bears to everything you can imagine, tigers. And exports and imports. Every community has some business that is global, one way or the other, in or out. And moving along that chain and seeing how the world affects that company and how that company affects the world are two great stories to tell. And then there's immigration. I can't remember how I stumbled onto this. I did a story when I was still writing for the Metro section on food pantries and how it was becoming sort of a growth industry, essentially lower middle class people going to food pantries. So I spent a lot of time in food pantries. And I was down in one in Greenwich, Connecticut, you know, one of the toniest communities in the world. And everybody coming in the door was Brazilian. And I'm thinking, this is weird. You know, having spent time in Brazil writing my Amazon book a long time ago, that sort of caught my attention. And then also sometime at the same time, I heard about all the hardwood and the floors being installed in these mansions was also coming from Brazil. So if you're the Greenwich Time newspaper, there's a great opportunity to sort of look through these invisible conduits back toward what's out there in the real world. I mean, not that Greenwich isn't part of it, but it's a very special part of it. So I'm just going to run down some examples of people who've done this. One thing, I stumbled on one story back when I was just starting out as a science journalist at Science Digest magazine. I was handed an assignment on lung transplants. When I was at Columbia J School, I did my thesis on organ transplantation, and so the editor, when I was I started out as a copy editor at Science Digest, and my editor knew about my background, and he said there were two lung transplants that had just happened, one in Toronto and one in Georgia, in Atlanta, I think. And both of the guys, I started reporting it. He just wanted a garden variety health, you know, story on frontiers of surgery. And it turned out both of these young men had been poisoned by paraquat, the herbicide. And so there's this little bell, some peripheral bell ringing in my head. This is weird. Why would the first two lung transplants taking place in the world both be the result of herbicide poisoning? And so I started just kind of tugging at that thread. And it led several months later to a long story about this sort of a hidden death toll from paraquat around the world, from people accidentally ingesting this Coca-Cola colored liquid that's been decanted into various bottles. And anyway, I won't fill you in the details, but it ended up being an IRE award winner only because, you know, the editor said go do lung transplants and I saw herbicides. So think again peripherally. I wish Tom Knutson had been able to come because his State of Denial series, which is all online and very, 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 very worth looking at, and is a perfect example of looking out from the state of California to what the footprint of that state is around the world, from the Amazon to Canada's boreal forests. And it was just a great example of the way to do this, to look along these linking lines. And Smithsonian Magazine recently did a really good piece on the banana, that Cavendish banana over there. I'm sure there's some somewhere. You know, the big, fat, juicy banana that everyone eats, that's the biggest source of fruit in the world, is very limited genetically, and now there's some disease running around. And it was just a really good portrait of our vulnerability to monoculture. But it starts with the banana on your plate. And the Portland, Oregonian, this really wasn't an environmental story, but they looked at the Asian financial crisis in 1999 or so through the French fry, and how their exports were linked to Asia was a way to kind of tell for the Pacific Northwest reader, you know, why you can't be just thinking about your everyday life anymore, because it's out there too. So I'll stop with that, and we'll start working our way down here. Dina, did you call me out of the blue? She brought me to the J School at Columbia when she was a student there in the 2-year program, and we've been in touch ever since. We actually overlapped in covering the Hudson River briefly, you know, when she was in Albany, and then she's gone down to Houston and written global stories and local stories, have won prizes, and then we'll move on.
Hi, everybody. I'm not Seth Barnstein, in case you haven't noticed. the French fry story is funny that you brought that up, Andy, because I was sitting here thinking it was a wonderful story, but I was working on my last project in Albany. I did about a project a year in Albany, which is what I tend to do. I've kind of averaged one a year in investigative project on the Adirondack High Peaks. And I was pitching the project to my editor, who's now my editor in Houston, actually, Jeff Cohen, and he kept saying to me, show me the spud. I don't see the spud, referring to the Oregonian French fry story and how wonderful it was done and had a great narrative. So that story kind of haunts me in terms of the pitch. I was really happy to sub in on this panel, and here's the reason why. I think because, you know, I'm going to represent kind of the local regional reporter. And you probably are thinking, well, I work for the Houston Chronicle, and it's one of the nation's largest newspapers, and that may be true. But I really am covering it on the local and regional level still. We're a very Texas-based newspaper. If I cover it nationally, I cover it just like many of you as what it means to Texans, what it means to Southeast Texans. And I think that a lot of us in the audience today are doing that. I mean, Andy's the global, it beats the global environment, and not many papers have that on their staffs, which is wonderful for the New York Times, and we run a lot of his stories in the Chronicle. But we're not going to be, you know, covering Mass versus EPA, the Supreme Court case. I wouldn't write about what Inhofe said on the Senate floor. You know, my beat is Texas. And so that's where I'm going to kind of take this. And, you know, I've been pretty successful, you know, in Texas pitching some big stories. So, you know, my solid panel's description, it talked about smokestacks and drain pipes, and I'm still kind of dealing with those stories in Texas. And I think a lot of us are with our editors, where they see the local power plant or the local chemical plant or even the sewage treatment plant, and they're still kind of interested in that because it's more real and you can kind of see it going into the water, or there's an event where you kind of see it in the air, and it's kind of more real than something like climate change, which is much more subtle and nuanced. You know, I did a story in 2005 in Houston that my paper spent $20,000 doing, and it basically told people the air in Houston was polluted. So that'd be a pretty good pitch. And, you know, we also, I think, on the regional level, you know, we've talked about some journalistic constructs here, you know, the biased balance, and I'm not going to kind of repeat those. Those are constructs that we deal with that make these issues challenging. There's also the local versus global. As we all know, in terms of the change in media that's going on right now, our papers are interested in going local, local, local. The more local, the better. And that's a really hard thing to talk about when you're talking about a global phenomenon. And I'm very fortunate in Houston to have a lot of really big companies that do a lot of things around the world that kind of give me entrees into this. And I agree with Andy in terms of thinking about how your local community is affecting the state next to you or vice versa. How, you know, I have Mexico in my backyard, so I do a lot of cross-border stuff with that. And also I want to make a comment is, you know, we also, some of us reside in states that aren't as progressive on these issues. You know, I cover Texas. And, you know, if you're a reporter in California and Schwarzenegger talks about regulating greenhouse gases, every paper in California can talk about that because they probably have something in their backyard that's going to be regulated, whether it's the car or whatever. This is not really part of the discourse really yet in Texas. And so when we emit more CO2 than any state in the country, largely because we house most of the oil and gas companies and their chemical plants and refineries. So, you know, this hasn't really kind of been part of the discourse, and that makes it challenging because as reporters, if we're not covering an event, and we all know we talk about, you know, Frank Allen's ooze versus news events on the environment, they don't have a lot of events. There's not many daily news pegs. We're covering what people are talking about. If the mayor's taking action or if a state legislator is, stepping forward. Well, I'm in Texas. You know, and if you're in Texas or New Mexico or Oklahoma, you know, that's not really part of the discourse. It makes it very challenging because people aren't really talking about it. And you, as a reporter, are kind of raising the issue then, and you're in that kind of situation. So besides those two additional problems kind of on the, I think that affect local and regional reporters, I'm going to kind of talk, I was thinking about this last night, and maybe it's because I've been only on the beat for 7 years, and I'm kind of always been in the beat in this transition phase where it seems all stories are subtle. but I really don't think that climate change, and I'm going to use that as an example because we've really talked about that a lot at this conference, is that different. You know, I did a story on air toxics. I didn't have dead bodies in the streets. I talked about risk. I talked about the risk that those pollutants posed. You know, we talk about, policy and science never jive on a lot of issues. I mean, we're still talking about, you know, I just saw the other day in my email bin that the scientific advisory panel for the EPA wants to then strengthen the ozone standard. It's not good enough. We're still talking about soot. There's a lot of uncertainties. I think where it differs is the scale of the effects. and how vast they are, and how they not, you know, with ozone, it's like, okay, it causes asthma and lung. With SO2, it's sulfuric acid rain and methyl mercury in fish. It's a very linear kind of thing. And with climate change, it's kind of all over the place. You got rising seas, you got moose, you got armadillos now in Illinois. I mean, it's just, you know, it's all over the place. And I think that makes it hard. But I also think that editors are smelling our fear. I think as journalists, you know, come on, you guys, you can't pitch to an editor unless you're absolutely 100% confident and are going to go on the mat and start wrestling over a story. I think they're smelling our fear on this issue. And I also think it has been infused by some of the other mistakes we've made lead up to Iraq War, et cetera, that they're saying, well, if we really go out on a limb on this issue and we screw this up, this is going to be another big problem for journalism.
You mean Mark Morano is going to come after you?
let me just give you some real practical tips, because I'm kind of a practical person. When all else fails, write a blog. put out a blog with the story. I've done that. I did a blog on a ship, the Dead Zone, very subtle story. If Mark Schlefstein's here, he knows what I'm talking about. Write a blog. I wrote a blog from the research vessel. I went and tested the water across the Gulf, and that sold the story. I mean, I really don't think they would have been very interested in a story about some scientists fueling themselves with Tootsie Rolls to stay awake for the 24-hour shifts to, like, cast CTDs in the water if I didn't blog from it, because that's, like, the new thing. So when all else fails, do something on the Internet. Second thing is, you know, bring in an expert. There was a case in Albany. It was my last project on the Adirondack High Peaks, and the editor, it was an editor-driven project, told me to talk about the threats to the Adirondack High Peaks, and one of those was climate change, because there had been a study back in the very, 1930 or 1940, looking at Adirondack High Peak plants, and they're not there anymore because it started to change. And, you know, I have a scientific background. I have a graduate degree in science, and they didn't believe me. So I was like, you know what? Okay, I'm just going to bring in the guy. And I organized lunch between the scientists and my editor. And, you know, you talk about people that really get inspired by this issue. You know, I was watching the Bill Moyers the Is God Green program a couple weeks ago, and he was talking to the guy, the head of the evangelical group, and he said he got inspired on this issue by talking to the scientists. I think that's really key, is to bring in a charismatic scientist who's really versed in these issues to talk directly to your editors. Use Andy. You know, one of the best, you know, come on. I mean, people in Houston are still like New York Times, Seth at the AP, Elfrin at the Washington Post. These guys are writing about it. That means something. You know, I remember when I was writing about climate change in Albany, the AP came out, I forget, Andy, whether it was in 99 or 2000, with a series about climate change. And on top of the wire was a big asterisk that said, the AP is now going to assume the following fact, that greenhouse gases are building, they're being caused by human emissions, and that the climate is warming. And let me tell you, when that came across the wires, my editors and I never had any other arguments about putting in a skeptic on that fact. So use the guys that are above you, that have obviously status in this field, to get your stories in. Also, to go back to state of denial, I judged that for the Best of the West contest that does Western State Environmental Journalism. It won. It's a phenomenal piece of journalism. And I think the reason why it was so effective is that we all are dealing with papers, the news you can use, the consumer news. They just love that, right? Go get your prom dress. In Houston, it's like Kin Sierra, all the 15-year-old girls, and go to David's Bridal, get their prom dress. I mean, it's look from the consumer perspective. It all goes back to consumption. Almost every environmental issue goes back to consumption, and everybody consumes. And then the last thing, you know, we talk about, Nancy, you kind of brought this up the other day in Frank's session, is you know, some of these scientific investigations. You know, I'm always a big fan of the scientific detective story that doesn't have an ending, that this search, they're detectives, you know, think CSI, you know, those kind of things. So I'll leave it with that, and I hope that helps you all with these very complicated issues.
Thank you. I'm hoping Gina Overholtzer is in kind of that Mount Olympus sort of academic view of this whole landscape of what newspapers are and are not covering, and her background both at the New York Times editorial board and as the ombudswoman at the Washington Post is helpful too, and just sort of having an overview point of view. And so if you could explore what you see as the challenges in getting this kind of stuff covered, that would be great.
Sure, thanks. Andy, good to be with you all. Good morning. This is my first SEJ convention, and I am very much impressed. It's a heck of a vigorous and invigorating gathering, and I'm delighted to be here with you. I think I'm here as the editor on the panel, but if so, it's a charade because I left the Des Moines Register, where I was then editor, 11 years ago. I don't think anyone in my among my academic colleagues would think of me as Olympian. I'm the most down there on the ground, get your feet dirty, academic that you can imagine. But this is a terribly important topic, and I'm happy to try to throw in my points, many of which, of course, are already put out here, because when you come third, that's what happens. When, as I sat here listening to all this, I thought of six or seven things that might be of some use, and then I'm eager to get into the Q&A period. One, of course, is how you pitch a story. It's terribly important, no matter what the story is, and of course that's a challenge when, I mean, you don't want to approach somebody talking about slow drip and non-point source pollution with an earnest look on your face as if this is going to save the world and therefore we have to run this, boss, kind of, which is what too many people do, I think. How well written the story is. We all know that science journalism can be enormously compelling, but we also know that it can be really dense stuff. And, you know, you all may have seen a piece that K.C. Cole did about, maybe, I think editors don't run this stuff because they don't understand it. Well, that's actually a good idea, not to run stuff that you don't understand. I mean, the story has to be understandable. Think how many copy editors you've talked to who say, oh, yeah, no, we put that. I had no idea what I was saying, you know, but, I mean, the story comes across my desk. I put a headline on it, gets in the paper. When I was ombudsman at the Washington Post and the war broke out in Kosovo, I remember getting a letter from a fellow who said, you know, I have a PhD in international relations, and I'll be damned if I can understand what your stories are trying to tell me. We really have to worry about whether we're laying something out there in a way that makes it accessible. And many of you all are dealing with very complex stories. So finding a way to present it and finding a way to present it to readers that is accessible and, in fact, even in the end, when you can, entertaining, is terribly important. We've all talked about local, but we've all talked about the fact that local is also global these days, which is the good news. In addition to all these more obvious points about, and terribly important points about, you all have businesses that are doing work abroad, and you all have individuals who have information about stories with global implications. I think one of the most important things you can do in this age when, and this is a blessing really, we shouldn't resist it. People want to be part of the news. We all know now that our readers, our viewers, our listeners don't want to be lectured to. Develop sources more broadly, people who are really interested in these topics. A great model for this, I think, and I commend it to all of you, is American Public Media's Public Insight Journalism. It's Minnesota Public Radio's national brand, American Public Media. Go online and Google Public Insight Journalism and look at what they have done to fashion a way to bring citizen input in that then informs the journalism rather than supplanting the journalism. It becomes a means of making the journalism better. I mean, they've created new positions in the newsroom. They call them analysts who assist in bringing in all this terrific information, and then they pass it along to the journalists who practice journalism on it. So it doesn't become a kind of, oh, God, we're doing this instead of this. It becomes, we'll do a better job of this and involve the citizens. Find ways to come in through topics you do know your editors are caring about. That, too, has been said. We've mentioned some: health, fitness, immigration, religion, personalities. I mean, profiles on local scientists who are doing these things are a way to get into different sections of the paper. Consuming, you're right, everybody consumes. Well, is something they're consuming harming them? I mean, think of things that are in the paper and your way into them. I would think that one of the most important things you could do, you're all very much aware of one another's good work, is make sure that the best of the work that your paper has access to through its wires does get into the paper, bring it to the attention of people, and then do a local sidebar on it. It may not get, the whole story may not get in, a piece of it may get in, but be sure that the best work that you know that's being done on science that your paper does have access to gets into the paper. Cultivate allies on the copy desk or among the mid-level editors or the people who select op-ed pieces, the people who select editors, letters to the editor. Cultivate allies who will help you watch for opportunities to get stories into various sections of the paper. And don't assume people are hopeless about this. I mean, a lot of people in the newsroom are probably interested in science, people you don't know. But then as I wrote that, my next point was, assume people are hopeless. I'm part of a group that, with the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, Don Kennedy of Stanford and Science Magazine and I are chairing a group of scientists and science journalists. Boyce Rinsberger is part of it, Casey Cole is part of it, Corey Dean, others whom you know, maybe somebody in this room, maybe Boyce is in the room, who are trying to think about, but you know, crossing the line between science and scientists and science journalists, how we can enrich science reporting. And we've thought about a number of things, and I would love to have the thoughts of others in this room. If you see me walking around sometime today between now and my panel at noon, then please come up to me and let's talk. But one of the conversations that keeps coming up is, well, we just need to persuade editors. Let's go to ASNE and talk about this. Let's go to APME and talk about this. Well, I have been convention program chair at ASNE and an officer of ASNE, and a program that goes and earnestly tells editors why they ought to care about science does not sound terribly promising to me. So, coming back around, I do think we have something we are up against. One thing you have to realize is that sitting in the editor's seat, you know, everybody on the staff thinks that the story he or she is bringing is the most important thing to get in the paper that day, and the news hole is shrinking, and on and on and on. And so it's, in the end, for me, the most important thing you can do is not just, if all else fails, think about the web, but before all else fails, think about the web. The great good news among what often looks gloomy is that we now have a tool that is far richer. I mean, I've been 35 years in the newspaper biz, and I put my love for newspapering before anyone else is in the room, if I must. But the fact is, we have at our fingertips a tool that is much richer and more flexible and deeper. And if you all in this room are not putting your work on the web, if you're not thinking about the ways to use these incredible tools, tools to aggregate and to scrape information off other screens and to bring people's voices in and have interaction, then you're really fools, because eyeballs are definitely going that way, and so are advertisers, even if it's only 7 or 8% of the revenue in most of our newsrooms. And the tools are yours to put at your disposal and to help your readers and listeners and viewers understand these issues. And they're out there ready to do it, and they will help make your reporting richer. And it wouldn't be at all unusual if, when you do a good job out there on the web, the stories come back into the newspaper because they gain life and they gain the attention of the editor. I've had this happen more than once on writing. I've been working on an immodestly named manifesto on the future of journalism, because I'm so tired of the lament. I'm ready to move on and embrace the possibilities. I commend it to you, if I do a little plug here, AnnenbergPublicPolicyCenter.org. And I've been, collaborating with people to write op-eds on things like, well, let's change the tax laws so that we reward shareholders for holding on to their reward companies for not doing short-term profit moves. And, this is not sort of op-ed that people readily snap onto. So we finally ended up putting it online a couple of places, Neiman Watchdog, other places. And it got attention, and two op-ed editors called us and said, would you mind if we used your piece? This kind of thing happens when you succeed on the web. And That's what I'd end by saying. You know, this is, when I was editor of the Des Moines Register, I was presiding over a paper that I came up through the ranks with Tom Knutson and with Jim Risser and with people who did very important environmental reporting that meant a lot to the people of Iowa and even nationally. And I know in this room there are many people whose work is every bit as good, and I think one of your best opportunities now is to look at the web first and foremost, and that's the thought I'd leave with you.
That's great.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So now it's your turn. I'm eager to hear examples from you if you've seen something along these lines that you think provides a template that others could follow. But also, any questions? There's two microphones here. Come and run up and fire away and identify yourself. Journalist first, right? How's that work?
It's on the bottom.
And we know you have the technical capability to do that, so you'll find it.
All right. My name is Jeff Burnside from WTVJ in Miami. Give us an example of the analysts that, for example, just give us a for instance, what kind of a story, what kind of information would they try to disseminate?
Well, this public insight journalism model, which really is very interesting, and I commend it to you because I think it's the smartest answer I have seen to this question that plagues us all about, well, you know, do we really do citizen journalism, and how do we distinguish between that and just a bunch of cacophonous voices of, you know, ignoramuses telling us what they know? Between that and acknowledging that, of course, the people we serve, taken together as a mass, have a wisdom of the crowd that we'd be fools not to tap into. What they're doing at Minnesota Public Radio, Michael Scholer heads this, S-K-O-L-E-R, and is they have developed a way to tap into that wisdom and feed it into the journalism. And one of the keys of the, I mean, first of all, they have all kinds of interesting software stuff going on where they invite people among their listenership to become part of one or another story. This started, you probably read something about this, when Northwest Airlines was having all kinds of difficulties. And they realized, you know, among our listenership, we've got pilots, we've got mechanics. Let's tap into their knowledge. So it started in a very specific way. But it's grown now so that when they do a story on, you know, what should small towns in Minnesota do to stave off economic disaster, they get all kinds of input from small towns, and they end up with these, you know, here's what Brainerd did, and here's what, and then the other small towns see this, and they've now developed it into a convening capacity, et cetera. But to get to your specific question, one of the most important elements of this is that once all this information comes in, much of it by invitation, and this is not, nobody portrays this as scientific polling or something. This is about going out and garnering knowledge. So once it comes in, it is looked at, chewed over, by analysts. I think they have three. These are people with journalism experience. And they, you know, they talk to the people, they analyze the information, and then they put it into form that will be useful to the journalists, and they pass it into the newsroom, where essentially it's just injected into the journalistic bloodstream, and then they do journalism on it. So it doesn't supplant the journalism, it enriches it. Then they do additional things. Sometimes they'll have forums and, you know, that are more sort of traditionally citizen-related. But the opportunities to make complex issues, to bring them alive on the web, are just endless. Again, Minnesota Public Radio, you may have seen this in some other formats, but they took the state budget and made a game out of it, essentially, so that people could do the budget, and they would have to, you know, make this choice, and if they chose child care, then they wouldn't, you know, this would what happens in another part of the budget. And, I mean, it was a real success, and people in the legislature started saying, well, I've been listening to my, you know, you could directly email your solution to your legislature, to your legislator, to your governor candidate or whatever. And, I mean, that's the kind of issue that science is in many ways, right? Something very difficult. Many science stories, many environmental stories are very difficult, and there are trade-offs. And so developing a model like that and putting it online, I mean, you talk about a way to make important stories interesting. Anyway, I commend you to American Public Media, Public Insight Journalism. It's worth a look.
That does sound great. It relates to some things we're doing at the time, trying to do at the Times, but we're obviously behind them. We've hired a guy. Well, anyway, we have a team now who's trying to come up with some of these unconventional ways to break down problems on the web. And Yeah, by the way, in terms of hiring, those who are seeking jobs in the next generation of journalism, you know, the Times is in a total freeze and or shrinkage except for our web component. And there are a lot of people with sort of cool black frame glasses who are 23, 24 with hair that kind of does this. They're the ones who are getting hired. So yeah. Do that. And they're all very webby. Very
and
webbish.
Make friends with them. I mean, if we don't
get over
our squeamishness about this is the only way it can possibly be done, you know, then we are history and we deserve to be. This is a tool we can use, you know, old folks and people who were brought up when journalism was done the way it was supposed to be done. I'm amazed that we don't embrace it more readily.
Yeah. Over here, and tell us who you are.
Is this on? It is. Jennifer Smith with Newsday. How are you? I'm fairly new to the beat, so hoping for just some thoughts you guys have both. As you're dealing with the subtle story, how do you walk that line? Reining your editors in from the sort of alarmist, factually incorrect way that they're selling it at a meeting, but still having it be urgent enough to get in the paper. So that one, and then, you know, as stories are getting shorter and shorter, if you have 600 words, any advice on the art of cramming accurate, readable, explanatory, while still trying to get a sense of why it matters to your readers, get a person in there or a local example. That's a lot of what I'm grappling with.
I'm gonna attempt the second one because it's a lot easier. Which, you know, and I've been starting to do this lately because our news hole has shrunk considerably, like a lot of other papers. Do it on the web. Okay, if you have a 600 word story, but you have a lot more material that's not going to get into the paper, I've just started doing original content on the web. Stuff, original content, text, not just graphics and video, and I've done all that too, but do the profile. Say you have a great guy that you can't really get in, but he's this great character in the story, and you can talk about just him. If you want to read more about so-and-so, log on to Newsday. So really use the web because newsprint's not an issue on the web. So you can get a lot in the web. And the second this first question you had about, that's a really tough one because I've obviously, especially with things like climate change, there's always that, you know, those editors that go to the, you know, 4 o'clock meeting are talking about getting it on A1. And you just have to be very diligent about you personally, about that line. And, you know, I've been in battles over that, over the course of my career of stepping too far. Now, remember even in the PCB story, for example, and I know, Andy, you dealt with this, but, you know, we all had heard the issue to Dredge was leaked, and you guys had it, and I was in Buffalo in a snowstorm, and I wrote it on the napkin on the airplane, the story, cause and then came back and typed it. But it was leaked, and basically there was this issue. There's all of these options with how to clean up the river, and they kind of had negated all of them but dredging, but they really didn't say dredging. And let me tell you how much we argued over that in terms of, are we going to go really hard and just say they're going to come out and dredge the river when they weren't really using that term quite yet? And we ended up, I know they did, I know you guys went and said just the D word, which everybody was afraid to say, but you have to kind of be very, very diligent because that's always the yin and yang, you know, is, you know, the sky is falling, but it's not because of this. And being, you know, a person that came from the science, I always go back to the science, and it has to be accurate, very accurate on that.
One thought along on this for me is don't be afraid to pull back from thinking that every paper in the journal that's come, the new development is the time to write the story. More and more, I'm pulling back from covering daily developments on climate science because it's, as I said last night, in many of the arenas that matter most, you know, are hurricanes now driven in terms of intensity by warming oceans or what's happening with Greenland ice. The study, you can tell how shallow that curve of knowledge is by the fact that the studies are doing this. And if you cover each one and think there's a front page thought just because today's study by one group looking at the GRACE data on Greenland is really alarming, and then not knowing that there's another study coming 2 weeks from now by another group that says it's actually one-third is alarming, that's what's going to poison your editors to the and your readers to the idea that they should be paying attention to this at all. Instead, pull back from the and find a feature in all of this. Wait for your opportunity to look at the broader trajectory of understanding on whatever it is, and then build into there those nut graphs that are as powerful as can be, but that also, I mean, one of the big stories of this century is that there aren't any easy answers anymore. Essentially, that's the story. The story is uncertainty is normal, and everyone has a stake in perpetuating the idea that this study tomorrow is going to clarify it all, and that just leads on an issue like climate to more stasis. So I said, basically, pull back from the temptation to think that today's paper, today's development in some one of these nuanced areas is God's truth. And then you can build a more powerful story and make a better case to your editor.
I'll just jump in with a couple of points in response to both of your good questions. One is, if you really do have only 600 words in the paper, then think of that in the hard copy paper as really a kind of a plug for other information, including we should be way less shy about saying and referring people to other interesting things in our stories in the newspaper. We ought to think of ourselves as a repository of information that make ourselves useful to people, refer them to other places, and preeminently refer them to your own work on the web. And yes, I know not everybody is on the web, but way more people are on the web than you're thinking. If you're not thinking of it as a place where you really can expand. I mean, 10 years ago, we would have said, oh, God, I don't know, shrinking news hole, what else can you do? There's a real answer now. You can do more. The other one is tough, too, because, of course, everybody has his or her job, and you want your editor to go in the news meeting and plug your story with enthusiasm, but you don't want to him or her to oversell it in such a way that it disappoints. It is, in the end, as you know, up to you, really, to be the steward, that the person who makes sure that it will not be overhyped so badly in display type or in editing, certainly, that you can't be proud of it and assure the paper that you are. It's a tough thing because you don't want the person to go into the news meeting and undersell it.
And one quick follow-up to that is I just spent several hours on Friday going through a story that I have running sometime in the next few days, if it ever gets through all those hurdles that you've all just mentioned, on climate technology, and putting in links. Links to every scientist now, there's a link to his homepage or where, you know, the Princeton Group Carbon Mitigation Initiative or whatever. It's work. It is work. No one asked me to do it. In fact, they'd be perfectly happy to run that story without them. But, you know, I just feel it's a better way to make that story a go-to place. And by the way, in terms of commerce, you know, the more time people spend on your newspaper's website, the more money your newspaper is making. But all that little exploratory click here, that adds up.
And it sure makes your work stickier. I mean, you're able now to give people so much more information than you could before. It's a great gift.
Rick?
Yeah, excuse me. Rick Pills, Climate Science Watch, Washington, D.C. Twice now I've heard in the sessions here the concern expressed that global warming coverage might have some analogy to the problem of the weapons of mass destruction. And I take it that the concern is that the WMDs weren't there and that if you push stories on global warming impacts, maybe it'll turn out that the impacts aren't really there either. Isn't it, and maybe it's because I look inside the Beltway so much at the administration and at the extent to which leading people on Capitol Hill have been enthralled to the global warming denial machine, isn't it a better analogy to say that the administration was willing to spin or misrepresent the intelligence on WMDs in order to support a predetermined political position, and analogously they've been willing to spin and misrepresent the intelligence on global warming and with comparable effects of undermining national preparedness for dealing with a real problem.
I'd like to weigh in on that. One thing I'll note is that everyone is, on both sides of the issue, is doing the same thing. When I wrote my Yelling Fire on a Hot Planet story for the Week in Review section in April, I got a very hot email back from a leading light in the environmental community, in the Hollywood environmental community, who is very close to Al Gore, and I'll leave it at that, who couldn't believe that I wrote that story. And basically, this person said that... oh boy. that don't you understand, this country runs on fear. And that's why certain people in portraying the climate story are eager and honestly not, embarrassed about pushing the fear button with it and making it and focusing on the worst case scenario and downplaying the uncertainties, those inconvenient uncertainties. And Rick, as you know, I'm very eager to disabuse people of any distortion of the science on any side, and I've been doing it with equal opportunity enthusiasm. But we as journalists have to be prepared for that on every side of this kind of a problem, not just from the administration. And by the way, you know, again, it's a no-brainer. If we're not looking at carefully at what's coming out of a partisan entity, then we're not being responsible.
I do think there is an analogy, though, between the two in terms of the run-up, of the coverage of the run-up to the weapons of mass destruction, run-up to the war, and in terms of earlier coverage, that has to do with our dispiriting willingness to be led by those in authority and our failure to question and our, you know, we've talked about all these things yesterday, false balance and craving conflict and, I mean, there are complex questions here, but I think all of this should serve as a warning to us to remember that when people in authority speak, even if they're in authority, we need to be questioning it. I feel like we do this with big questions. We did it when I was on the editorial board of the New York Times. I feel like we did this with Star Wars. I remember hearing people talk, science reporters and military reporters, about how we didn't really believe the Strategic Defense Initiative had the kind of potential that our stories and our editorials even made it sound as if it had. I just think we are way too much creatures of the conventional wisdom, of the kind of leader, too willing to be led by the leaders, especially in various times in our nation's life, and certainly after 9/11, as we all know. So I think there is some analogy there.
One quick follow on that, too. The good news on that, in terms of society, is that there's always potential, as many people in the sort of sociology of science, the sociology of public policy have told me this, when there's significant uncertainty on an issue of import, leadership is the thing that swings it one way or the other. So many people are saying right now that if there is a leader who decides to latch on to this climate energy challenge and make it the thing and portray it as a universe with uncertainty but with a sense of mission, they can take us in one direction or the other. And, you know, lately it's been in one direction and it could go in the other direction as well. So most people don't determine policy. A very small number of people do. And the rest of, there is a follow the leader norm in human nature. Over here.
I was wondering.
Tell us who you are.
Oh, sorry. I'm Nancy Basil-Chuck. I'm the conference chair.
I know who you are.
I can yell really loud if you like. As I'm listening to you all talk about portraying uncertainty and how do we do this, I'm thinking about a lot of the scientific scenarios that I've seen. EPA did this a while ago where they sort of laid out possible futures, possible scenarios for climate change. And I guess I'd like you guys to comment on the value of writing a story in that, using that approach, and also the pitfalls of using that approach. Because it seems to me that you could very much err on the side of being a little too cautious by presenting all these scenarios, but you could also be too extremist. However, this is a way that people think, and so I'm curious as to what you, in your infinite wisdom, have to say about this.
I think that, you know, we talked about this, that climate change and global warming is prospective. You know, there's a lot of issues like that. We do that all the time, if you think about it. You know, anybody in this room that's covering ozone and cleaning up ozone, all of those cleanup strategies are based on models that are predicting what's going to happen if the numbers are right, okay, which in Texas are about 6 to 7 times off. But that's all about predicting, using computer models, what these strategies, lawn mowing at certain times of day, driving your car, are going to do. So, and, you know, look at political writers. I mean, how many times as reporters do we talk about, look ahead with polls about who's going to win the election? I mean, there's a lot of prospective stories. I think that when you're talking about the climate change and, you know, those regional reports that we all know so well, you can go on the EPA's website and click Texas, and it tells you, you know, oh, the sea change, Galveston's going to be underwater or what have you. We just have to be very diligent about how exactly they came to those conclusions and how likely they are. You know, when you talk about climate change, I love to cover risk and I do a lot of stories on risk. It's really when it comes down to it about that gamble, about, you know, how much of a risk are we going to take? Are we going to wait until, you know, sea levels are rising and everything's going to be underwater? But you can say that about any other story. You can say that, are we going to wait to regulate toxic air pollutants in a better way, actually have federal standards until there's bodies on the ground? Or are we going to talk about, you know, the risk? So.
One of the things that's really important in this realm, and I do think there's a value to the one thing science brings to the table, the only thing science really brings to the table in terms of policy on climate is scenarios. If then, and it's up to society to determine things like how dangerous is that, how unacceptable is, given those different outcomes that could be for like the pace of sea level rise, the pace of abrupt climate change, whatever. And that's the thing. But saying it's a projection, these are projections, these are ifs. This is not a prediction is a really important thing, getting away from the idea that scientists are telling us what will happen. And that gets around the idea that people are going to get burned out if it doesn't come to pass, because it's all if-then stuff. Every computer model is just doing an if-then scenario. By the way, the other thing about predictions is, my God, in doing this climate technology story I've just finished, I read a paper, one of the most sobering papers I've ever read, on the value of energy forecasts, you know, actual predictions. Over the last 30 years, Bob Hirsch, it was Hirsch and someone else who did this study, and basically energy forecasts are the most meaningless exercise and very profitable. These companies and institutions make big money doing this, and they're always wrong. Whether it's how much solar will we have, solar capacity in 20 years, or how much, where will oil prices be? My God, it's worth looking up. I'll see if I can find the URL. But making sure your reader understands what you're describing in the story is important too. But I do think sort of painting a picture of the future is interesting. Scientific American, that September issue on energy, they had these images that graphic artists did. That's basically a split world. There's like carbon world. And it's all grotty and raining like black rain and smokestacks and flooding on the coast. And then the other side is clean, neat solar wind world. And there's a combine running through a biofuels field with solar panels on it. And it looks so beautiful. And of course, the reality is going to be a mixture. It's not going to be a neat, clean. We're not coming to a... But it does get the reader's attention at any rate, showing what two possible futures might be.
And just to add to that, you know... I think it's also really important, and it's a nice entree into the story of who's listening to the projections. You know, I had lunch yesterday. I was at the Climate Change, the Finance and Business Implications Network lunch, and we were talking about shareholders who have convinced Apache, a Houston-based oil company, to talk about the possible regulation of CO2. And when you have businesses responding, that's another entree. You know, if they're concerned about it, you know, that's another way to get into the story.
I'm Barbara Haig, and I am a yellow tag, but I used to be a journalist. I worked in broadcasting for a dozen years and have taught journalism.
So you're a recovering journalist?
Yes, I am. Okay. But now I'm a communications consultant, and I was talking to Dina about this yesterday. The idea of framing these stories as sustainability stories and being able to define to editors what sustainability is, the impact of social, financial, and environmental issues, and defining those, the stories, as the risks and the opportunities. And where this puts this, in my mind, is on the business pages, because as we were talking yesterday, businesses truly are getting what sustainability is, not so much of the environmental portion of it, but because of the financial risks that are out there. We talked about insurance risks. We talked about the regulatory risks. But so my question is, what do you think about trying to frame some of this, almost branding this as sustainability?
Yeah, well, right. Well, say that.
when she brought this up at the table, I just said, never use the word sustainability in a pitch to your editors.
And frankly, don't use the word environment.
That's, exactly. That's where I'm going at. I'm saying risks and opportunities.
This whole organization should go underground, frankly. Because all these stories, every climate story is an energy story. Every climate equals energy. And energy is a story that your editors understand.
Yeah, but risk and opportunity is an interesting way to look at it. And having it be a business story, thinking about it with business reporters is an interesting way to look at it. But also, that would lend itself to an analysis piece on your forum or some Sunday opinion section, I would think.
Thanks.
Is that rain, I hear?
No, it's there.
Oh, okay. It could be rain. extreme events.
Quit talking about that. I've got a 3:30 flight. It isn't funny.
Oh, no.
I'm Dan Smith. I'm making a documentary on the American elm, but my day job is with the...
Isn't it kind of late?
Well, it's... No. The return of the American elm, and the which is making a comeback. But you asked earlier, Andrew, for maybe an example. So the front page of the Washington Post on Labor Day, Blaine Harden had a story on tree planting drive seeks to bring a new urban cool. It's about the low cost, the impacts for global warming on urban tree canopy increases in strategy. So I guess one question I would have for you or all of you is that, do you know your tree canopy? You know, what is your tree canopy in your community? And in New York City, 23% tree canopy. The mayor within the next month is going to be announcing a new tree canopy goal there. Boston is in the same position. Baltimore announced a doubling from 19% to 38% over the next 30 years. There are over 100 organizations around the country that are doing local urban forestry that are most of them very aware of the implications for this. The other is there's at least 10 research units. So right here in Burlington is the Northeast Forest Service region science folks. And there's a poster out in the hall, but these folks are the ones that have done the data analysis and the remote sensing for the whole region from D.C. to Boston. So they're, and not only are they doing it for the big cities, but because they, you know, they live in a community, they're right now doing it for Burlington. You know, they've done it for Annapolis, where some of the research folks live. So they're doing it in the smaller community. So there's a lot of this available. And I just wondered if, if that's another angle that you see as viable.
This is a story an editor could love. Think graphics. I mean, people do care about trees. I think this is a story an editor could love. And thinking about how to get this kind of information in the paper and on the web when it already exists is one of those kind of no-brainer things.
No, and I did that story in Houston because the mayor, our mayor, Bill White, is very proactive on kind of the whole green city, cool roofs model. There's been studies about the canopy in Houston, which the percentage is way low. it's a wonderful angle. And, you know, there's a couple people, you know, on this beat that are really enthusiastic. Birders are one, and tree people are probably second in line. So it's a wonderful way to get into the story.
Yeah, we've got a tip sheet out there that has a lot of these contacts.
Oh, that's good to know. And the SEJ website is a good place, and the listservs are a good place for this kind of idea to propagate, so to speak.
Great. You want to wrap up?
Well, thank you very much for listening. I think we're ready to pull the plug and move to the next rounds here.
Yep. Thanks very much, Andy, Dina, Geneva. That was great.